Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. What a week, and it's only Thursday, but there's been really only one story in Washington, D.C. and across the country. There has been an enormous amount of talk, not just this week, but over the last month, about violent extremism and the people who embrace it, the dangerous people. Those people are domestic terrorists, we're told. They must be put down by force. The war on terror has moved stateside. Extremists have breached our walls. They are inside our country. And in response, we must hunt them down. Doing that is existential. Our country depends on it. Our lives depend on it. Now, we're hearing those words nonstop on cable news, but not just on cable news. We're hearing the very same thing from elected officials, including some Republican elected officials. We're hearing it from the leaders of federal law enforcement agencies and of the intelligence agencies. We're hearing it from the Pentagon. Just this week, the new Secretary of Defense ordered the entire U.S. military to, quote, stand down while investigators cleanse the ranks of political extremists. And, of course, we're hearing it from the business establishment, from Wall Street and the tech monopolies, from the massive multinational corporations that increasingly control the contours of American life. All of them are now on the hunt for political extremists. And on one level, that does not sound bad, because no sane person is for political extremism, especially violent extremism. We're against it. We're for moderation. We're for incremental change. We're for the consent of the governed. We said that every day for 4 years, and we meant it. We don't like extremists either. We attack them regularly. But it's not enough to be against something. You have to be more precise than that. What is it that you're against? In order to root out a problem, you have to know what it is. You need a sense of what you're looking for. You need a clear sight picture. You have to define the terms. And here's the remarkable thing about this public conversation we're having. No one is doing that. Have you noticed? None of these newly energized and highly empowered extremist hunters have told us exactly what an extremist is. So we're left to guess. We're left to look around nervously to see if we can spot one. Hoping against hope the whole time, they're not talking about us, are they? And if they are, what exactly are they doing? How are they hunting these extremists they keep telling us about but will not describe? We now know part of the answer to that question. This show has obtained exclusively evidence that Bank of America, the second largest bank in the country with more than 60 million customers, is actively but secretly engaged in the hunt for extremists in cooperation with the government. Bank of America is, without the knowledge or the consent of its customers, sharing private information with federal law enforcement agencies. Bank of America effectively is acting as an intelligence agency, but they're not telling you about it. In the days after the January 6th riot at the Capitol, Bank of America went through its own customers' financial and transaction records, a lot of them. Now, these were the private records of Americans who had committed no crime. People who, as far as we know, had absolutely nothing to do with what happened at the Capitol on January 6th. But at the request of federal investigators, Bank of America searched its databases looking for people who fit a specific profile. Here's what that profile was, and we are quoting. Customers confirmed as transacting, either through bank account, debit card, or credit card, purchases in Washington, D.C. between January 5th and January 6th. Number two. Purchases made for hotels, Airbnb, RSVPs in Washington, Virginia, or Maryland after January 6th. Number three, any purchase of weapons or at a weapons-related merchant between January 7th and their upcoming suspected stay in the D.C. area around Inauguration Day. And four, airline-related purchases since January 6th. End quote. So what do you notice about that profile? Well, the first thing you notice is that it's remarkably broad. Any purchases of anything in the city of Washington, D.C., any overnight stay anywhere in the three-state area that spans hundreds of miles, any purchase, not simply of legal firearms, but instead anything bought from a, quote, weapons-related merchant, T-shirts included, and then any airline-related purchases, not just flights to Washington, flights to anywhere, to Omaha, to Thailand. That is a very, very wide net, an absurdly wide net. Bank of America identified a total of 211 customers who met these, quote, thresholds of interest. And it was at that point, the show has learned, Bank of America turned over the results of its internal scan to federal authorities, apparently without notifying the customers who were being spied upon. Federal investigators then interviewed at least one of these unsuspecting people. And that person, we've learned, hadn't done anything wrong and in the end was cleared. Imagine if you were that person. The FBI hauls you in for questioning in a terror investigation, not because you've done anything suspicious. You haven't. You bought plane tickets and visited your country's capital. You thought you could do that. You thought it was your country. Now they're sweating you because your bank, which you trust with your most private information, information of everything you buy, has ratted you out to the feds without telling you, without your knowledge. Because Bank of America did that, you are being treated like a member of Al-Qaeda. What country is this? It doesn't matter how much you despise Donald Trump or how much you believe that hatred of Trump justifies suspending this country's ancient civil liberties. Going through that experience would scare the hell out of you. Absolutely. A terror suspect, you would think? Does anyone else know about this? Is there a record of this interview? Will I lose my job because of it? That actually happened to someone. It's hard to believe it, but it did. We asked Bank of America about this. They confirmed it actually happened by not denying it. Here is their statement in full, which manages to make the whole thing even creepier, assuming that's possible. Quote, "We don't comment on our communications with law enforcement." Well, apparently not. "All banks," it continues, "have responsibilities under federal law to cooperate with law enforcement inquiries in full compliance with the law," end quote. Now, the last part, from a lawyer's perspective, is the essence, in full compliance with the law. It's the law. We had no choice. But that's not true. Bank of America did have a choice. The bank could have resisted turning over information on its innocent customers to federal investigators, but Bank of America did not do that. Nor is it clear, if we're going to be precise about it, that what Bank of America did is even legal. It turns out it's not simple. It's a gray area. We spoke to a number of lawyers about this today. Some of them told us that what Bank of America did might in fact not be legal and could in fact be challenged in court. One knowledgeable attorney pointed us to 12 U.S.C. 3403. That's a federal law that allows banks to tip off the feds to any information that, quote, may be relevant to a possible violation of any statute or regulation. Now, the DOJ instructs federal agents to remind banks of that law, and of course they do with maximum aggression. But the question is, legally, what constitutes information that may be relevant to a possible crime? Buying a muffin in Washington, D.C. on January 5th? Does that make you a potential domestic extremist? According to Bank of America, yes. Yes, it does. This is the moment when, for the sake of our country and our grandchildren who will live here, we need to pause and breathe deeply, searching for wisdom, avoiding hysteria, and ask, what are the rules? What, for God's sakes, is a political extremist? A lot hangs on that question, maybe everything. Please tell us. But they won't tell us. Pointedly, they won't tell us. Today at the White House, for example, the new National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, told reporters that, quote, "domestic extremism is the urgent crisis of our time. Rooting out domestic political extremism is more important than anything else, more important than getting a job, running your business, tending to your family." But Sullivan did not, again, tellingly, explain what it is.
So Build Back Better isn't just about economics. It's about national security as well. And then it's about the set of issues that working families in this country are facing every day that are challenging their lives and livelihoods. The pandemic, climate change, the threat of domestic violent extremism.
Domestic violent extremism, there it is, the worst thing. But no sense of what that means. We're starting to believe they're not defining it for a reason. What's the other explanation? Yesterday, an op-ed in the New York Times asked this question. Are private messaging apps, the next messaging apps, Signal, a bunch of others, they're encrypted, no one can read it. The New York Times doesn't like this. Why? Because if they can't see what you're saying, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to say it. As the newspaper put it, quote, "The shift to private messaging has renewed a debate over whether encryption is a double-edged sword. While the technology prevents people from being spied upon, it might also make it easier for criminals and misinformation spreaders to do harm without getting caught." Notice, criminals and misinformation spreaders are in the same sentence. They're pretty much the same thing. What's a misinformation spreader? Well, that's someone who doesn't agree with the New York Times, obviously a violent extremist, and they're dangerous. If you think we're joking, we're not. They're pulling this thread every day. According to the Democratic Party, we need to start screening the social media accounts of people who work for the government just to make sure.
So it's time for us to open our eyes and recognize what's going on. The fact that we do not look at social media of potential recruits into the military flabbergasts me.
The leftists that now dominate the Democrat Party hate just about everything associated with American tradition, from flags to monuments to even Christianity, which is why it was bitterly ironic that Joe Biden should communicate his latest ideological purge during an appearance at the National Prayer Breakfast.
We just have to open our eyes. We've just witnessed images that we've never imagined. Images that now we'll never forget. A violent assault on the U.S. Capitol, assault on our democracy, on our Capitol. A violent attack that threatened lives and took lives. And we know now we must confront and defeat political extremism, white supremacy, and domestic terrorism.
Well, using the Capitol Hill riots, of course, as the justification, I knew it was only a matter of time until Biden and his administration would turn their sights on the U.S. military. Now, Biden's Pentagon chief has announced, we mentioned this briefly last night when it broke, a stand down of all U.S. military forces in order to scour the ranks for so-called extremists. Now, Lloyd Austin, the new Secretary of Defense, hinted at a possible purge during his confirmation hearing.
I will fight hard to stamp out sexual assault and to rid our ranks of racists and extremists. The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies. But we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks.
Of course, well, what he really meant then and what he would like to do now is rid the military of all strong conservatives and, of course, Trump supporters. Now, think of all the challenges America's facing at this moment, with the rise of China especially. And this is what our defense chief is focused on? Now, Reuters is reporting that the Biden administration doesn't even have a plan for how to conduct its so-called review or what the stand down would even mean or look like. But one thing is for sure, if this is substantive and not symbolic, it will do grave damage to our military preparedness and morale. Our men and women in uniform have been asked to sacrifice multiple tours, many of them, for so long. And oftentimes, ridiculous engagements, idiotic wars. And now the Biden administration rewards them by casting them as potential domestic terrorists, ticking time bombs of white supremacy? You can always count on think tank generals whose salaries are funded by rich donors to side with the Democrats on an issue like this. Like Thomas Clauditz, a retired Army Brigadier General, who told Fortune magazine, he's really worried about the enemy within, saying, we're probably talking about thousands across the Department of Defense. Many of them will have already run their mouth, put things on social media. Now, people like him will claim that it's fine for defense personnel to have strong political views that are conservative. But in practice, we already know how this is all going to play out. Look at how fast the National Guard moved against its own ranks after the Capitol riot, apparently vetting more than 25,000 National Guardsmen, removing a dozen or so from inaugural duty, some on dubious grounds, by the way. So you post something on Facebook about, I don't know, standing for the national anthem at football games, and the next thing you know, you could be labeled a white nationalist. You text a friend about how you think Trump stood for the forgotten man and woman, and you're practically a KKK member. If Democrats were really concerned about stamping out extremism, they'd be looking in the mirror. How many wacky, incendiary, inflammatory, defamatory, hateful things have been said by their members over the past 5 years, or heck, just over the past month? We should devote just an entire show just to left-wing extremism, which runs the gamut from Antifa to BLM to open border zealots who think we're all living on stolen land. And where were Biden and friends when Islamic radicals infiltrated our military ranks during the war on terror? Now, thankfully, some of these attacks were thwarted, but many innocent Americans were also killed.
The Muslim convert who killed a U.S. Army recruiter in Little Rock, Arkansas.
The Army private arrested and charged with allegedly plotting an attack at Fort Hood. PFC Nasser Abdul was arrested at a motel in Killeen, Texas.
Police say a Muslim American, Muhammad Abdulaziz, opened fire at two military centers, killing four Marines and a sailor.
The FBI is investigating the Pensacola shooting as an act of terror. Why the gunman's time in Saudi Arabia is being examined.
Okay, sometimes we forget that all of this happened. Where were the calls for the immediate vetting of all troops with connections to Islamic extremist groups? Now, I was doing this on radio every day during most of this time period. And not only did Democrats not demand that type of vetting, they accused us of Islamophobia for even raising concerns.
Racially profiling predominantly Muslim neighborhoods. It's wrong. It's counterproductive. It's dangerous.
Republican hopefuls need to come out and be against this kind of Islamophobia.
It's our responsibility to reject proposals that Muslim Americans should somehow be treated differently.
It would be an even greater tragedy if our diversity becomes a casualty here.
Well, diversity, unless, of course, it means respecting the opinions and beliefs of conservatives or devout Christians or other religious denominations. Instead of lecturing us about the importance of tolerance, like they did back then, leftists are gleefully calling for an ideological cleansing of the ranks.
What do you make about this through line of military service and white supremacy?
I was thinking the Guard is 90 some odd percent, I believe, male. Only about 20% of white males voted for Biden.
Anybody who cannot pledge allegiance to their mission and may be pulled by other views, they need to be removed from the Guard.
Safety has to be our first priority.
Safety for whom? It's certainly not going to make Americans safer having the military turn to an arm of the DNC. What about the military members of faith or who vote Republican? I mean, you heard the reference to, oh, they're all men, white men. So if you're a white male Christian, maybe you voted Republican, maybe even like Trump, you're immediately suspicious. You're a suspect. How are any of those people supposed to feel safer now? Of course they're not going to feel safe. So what's the real goal here? Preventing any dissent in the country when their policies slowly but surely are depriving us of liberty and prosperity? Well, do the Democrats plan more lockdowns for coronavirus mutations? The requirement for vaccine certificates for travel? Are they worried that members of the military are going to side with the Constitution instead of crazy social justice warriors who want to remake America and even remake the military? Finally, a message to the Republicans like Liz Cheney. This is your opportunity to show everyone that you'll fight harder against the Democrats than you do against Donald Trump. Refuse to allow a single U.S. taxpayer dollar to fund this ideological and un-American purge of the U.S. military. Or expect a lot of us to push for steep cuts in military spending. After all, why should we fund an organization that Democrats plan to use not to protect us, but to restrain us in order to protect themselves and their grip on power? And that's the angle.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Happy Wednesday. On November 22, 1963, a man called Lee Harvey Oswald murdered the President of the United States. There were a lot of questions about what happened, but there was never any question about who Lee Harvey Oswald was. Oswald was a passionate and committed communist. In 1959, he gave up his American passport and defected to the Soviet Union. There, he married a Russian woman and lived in Minsk. 3 years later, he returned to this country and immediately began attending rallies in support of Fidel Castro, the communist leader of Cuba. In the fall of 1963, Oswald traveled to Mexico City and met with KGB agents there. A few months before, in Dallas, he tried to murder General Edwin Walker because Walker had given speeches attacking communism. So Lee Harvey Oswald never hid his politics, not for a moment. He talked incessantly about communism to anyone who would listen. And yet many Americans never really understood what Lee Harvey Oswald believed, and they didn't understand it because news outlets didn't tell them. Instead, almost immediately, the media began spinning a very different story. President Kennedy, they suggested, had been murdered by conservatives, possibly by conservatism itself, by hate, as they often put it. The explanation was never very precise, but the idea was always the same. Right-wingers killed Kennedy. The Soviet Union, naturally a suspect in this crime, was happy to agree with the assessment. As a Soviet spokesman put it, moral responsibility for the Kennedy assassination lay squarely with, quote, Barry Goldwater and other extremists on the right. In the end, the coordinated lying paid off. A year later, Senator Barry Goldwater lost to the incumbent Democrat Lyndon Johnson in a historically lopsided presidential election. By that point, many voters associated Goldwater with murder. As the decades passed, the media kept repeating this lie. By the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, the New Yorker magazine was still blaming, quote, anti-communism for the fact that an avowed communist had murdered the president. Just because it's absurd doesn't mean they won't say it with a straight face, and they do. By now, it's likely that most Americans believe that's exactly what happened, and why wouldn't they believe it? That's what they've been told. That point is worth ruminating on and remembering. History is a political tool. History is not simply a record of what happened. History is a way to shape the future. History is used to hurt some people and to help other people gain power. History is never neutral. We're watching our own history being written before us right now. Consider this clip. It is from MSNBC last night. In this clip, famous historian Michael Beschloss compares what happened at the Capitol on January 6th to what happened to America on September 11th.
This was a president of the United States inciting an insurrection, a terrorist attack on Congress. We observe 9/11. We remember the fact that there were attacks that landed, one that almost landed, which was an effort to fly an airplane into the Capitol, kill a lot of members of Congress. That almost happened. Here is a terrorist attack that did happen.
So we observe 9/11, he says. Going forward, we must observe January 6th. Maybe we'll need a memorial on the Mall. As Beschloss has said repeatedly in the last 24 hours, and very pointedly, we must, quote, never forget. Now, it's true it's pretty easy to make fun of Michael Beschloss. Beschloss is a historian in the same sense that 7-Eleven is a restaurant. Like a convenience store, Beschloss is everywhere. It could be 3 in the morning on a cold December night, and you could still pick up a pint of Michael Beschloss if you needed one. Just don't consume too much of it. It's not nutritious. And yet still, an awful lot of people eat this stuff. And that's the point. Michael Beschloss sells what is called popular history. It's the kind of history that sticks. And that's just the history being assembled in print and on cable news, which at this point, and let's be honest about it, are the media of choice for those of us who lived in a world before the internet. They're media for older people. For Americans under 30, history is written exclusively on social media. And that's where the real demagogues live. Tech platforms are the domain of people for whom factual reality is not even a consideration. It's a completely different way of thinking. Once you've decided that biology itself is not real, you are free from the conventional restraints of reality. At that point, what actually happened in a given place at a given time is totally and completely irrelevant. Ideology is all that matters. Sandy Cortez is a master of this medium, of course. Watch her description of the events of January 6th, broadcast to kids across the country on Instagram.
I jump into my bathroom. And I close the door, and I just keep hearing these bang, bang, bang. I open the door when all of a sudden I hear that whoever was trying to get inside got into my office. And I just hear, where is she? Where is she? And this was the moment where I thought everything was over.
So we played clips like that for you before, and we've always made fun of them. There she is again, defender of the common man, yammering on about the only subject she really cares about, herself, wallowing around in Lake Me like it's interesting to anyone but her. Narcissism on parade, the perfect symbol of a culture dying from self-involvement. We've said that before, and we have laughed as we did. But actually, it's not funny. People will believe this crap. Some already do. Anyone who was physically present at the Capitol that day knows it's ridiculous. There were no rioters in Sandy Cortez's hallway. Trump voters weren't trying to kill her. Neither were other U.S. senators. A lot of the rioters were angrier at Mitch McConnell than they were at any Democrat. To some extent, what you saw on January 6th was an intra-party struggle. Not all of it, but some of it. An act of mindless destruction aimed at Republican leaders, born of long simmering frustration. The people who run the Republican Party don't care about the people who elect them. That has long been true. Republican voters finally figured it out. It's one of the main things they learned during the Trump years. And on January 6th, they exploded. Lindsey Graham was likely in graver danger than Sandy Cortez or Ilhan Omar. They were literally calling poor Mike Pence's name. He didn't do anything. They were furious with him. Now, that's not a defense of anyone's behavior, much less a defense of rioting, which, unlike the other channels, we do not support and will never support. It's not even an ideological point. It's just true. That's what happened. But at this point, the truth doesn't matter. What matters is who gets to write the history of what happens, who gets to define what the truth is. They're the ones who will control the future. That's why they're doing it. There's a reason that within hours, Democrats began describing the riot as a racial attack. It was confusing to hear that at first. If you watched it and knew what happened, we were completely confused. Awful as it was, there was nothing racial about what happened that day. Claiming otherwise is absurd. It's a fantasy. It's a lie. But no one pushed back against that lie, so they kept repeating it. Now, weeks later, it is the accepted version of what happened. Powerful lawmakers just say it from the House floor like it's fact, like it's been proven in some objective inquiry, and everyone knows it's true.
America has been through a civil war, world wars, a Great Depression, pandemics, McCarthyism, and now a Trumpist and white nationalist insurrection.
White nationalist insurrection. Again, it was awful. It was not that. But you've got to ask yourself, why are they claiming that it was that? Think about it. You know the answer. Everyone knows the answer, though almost everyone is too cowardly at this point to say it out loud. And the answer is this. They're saying that despite the fact they know it isn't true, so they can lump you in with the people who broke into the Capitol and punish you for crimes you did not commit and never supported. If what happened on January 6th was a riot, and it was, then we can arrest the rioters and punish them, and we should. If what happened on January 6th was an insurrection, however, if it was a failed revolution, an attempted coup, then it's something else entirely. If it's that, then we need a military response. We need a new war against our own population. And not surprisingly, that's exactly what they're calling for.
Even at the seeming height of the crisis immediately after 9/11, there really weren't that many members of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And the thrust of our campaign there was, yes, to hunt down al-Qaeda, but primarily to remove the supportive environment in which they were able to flourish. And that meant fighting the Taliban. And I think that is the heart of what we need to deal with here. Hunting down people who are criminals.
Hunt them down like al-Qaeda. And to be completely clear, we're not overstating this. We are not hysterical. We're just close listeners. By them, he means Americans who were nowhere near the Capitol on January 6th, had no role in what happened that day, and didn't support it. That's the assessment from a former CIA official who spent years hunting al-Qaeda in the Middle East. No one in Washington appears to think this kind of talk is alarming in a formerly peaceful republic like ours. Just today, Senator Mitch McConnell, the leader, sent out a tweet blasting Vladimir Putin for some misdeed or other. In the U.S. Senate, Russia is still the real threat. Not quite as upset about China somehow. But what McConnell didn't mention, and almost never does, are his own voters, the ones now being reclassified as al-Qaeda terrorists and treated accordingly. On Monday, the Washington Examiner, which claims to be a right-of-center publication, whatever that means at this point, ran a piece by a former CIA officer called Kevin Carroll. According to Kevin Carroll, quote, "We saw five dead in the January 6th attempted coup d'etat." Now, Carroll didn't explain who exactly those five people were or how exactly they died. It would be nice to know that, but facts were not the point. The point was that this was an attempted coup d'etat and the U.S. government needs to act accordingly. Again, we are quoting here, quote, "We defeated al-Qaeda and can do the same thing to the fascist thugs who attacked our democracy last month, but only if we take similar hard measures against the enemy within." Treating Americans like al-Qaeda, the enemy within. Apparently, that's the new conservative position on the riots of January 6th. And why wouldn't it be the position of everyone in this country? Because that's the history they are writing. And we're letting them. But we should be prepared for the consequences of that history.